Okay, today is November 4th. We'll start forthwith. It's Rosh Chodesh Kislev. I should have brought a Hanukkah treat, but I didn't. I was running as it is. I wish I had enough. I had gold coins I brought to my house yesterday. At least we'll put it on the table.
There we go. We can
like
think about it.
There we go.
Three people could take.
Oh, hard to believe. Almost Hanukkah.
I know. Oh, great. Four people could take. Okay.
It's milk chocolate. I don't eat milk chocolate.
Okay, good. So Sandy doesn't eat milk chocolate, so everybody else could take. It's already been decided. So pass it around. Great. So let's just start. We're only doing three mitzvot today.
We're in our new book.
Right. Cool. So we're starting with just a thought that bridges Vayikra.
I've got to order mine for my coffee.
Yeah, right. We're starting with a thought that bridges Vayikra to Bamidbar. So the book of Vayikra, which is what we just finished, is sort of like a parenthetical book. Meaning, you start with the stories in Genesis, moving into Exodus, and they continue in Bamidbar, but Vayikra is stuck in the middle of how to do a bunch of stuff. But it's not the narrative, really. Even though there may be some narrative in it, but it's really a book of a lot of laws and how to keep them. So Bamidbar continues with the narrative, but what's really interesting here is that we end Vayikra with the counting of the sheep, remember, the tithing of the sheep. And we start Bamidbar with the counting of the people as the flock. Right? So what's the connection there? So there's a connection of counting and counting. But really Bamidbar is moving us. The type of counting is counting each person according to their household, according to their tribe, part of the nation. So that we see we're nation, divided into tribes, divided into households, made up by individuals. So this is part of the foundation of the Jewish people, is that each individual counts, and we're each important as part of the whole. So we're not just a whole, where the individuals don't matter, and we're not just individuals, where we count as much without being part of the whole. We count more as Jews when we're part of the whole. And it's both, so that we are part of a whole and we're individuals. Each individual counts and is necessary. So each family is different, each tribe is different, and we recognize the differences of the families and the tribes and the individuals as subsets of each, and we all count towards the whole. So the first count is the count of the half shekel, which is you count as a contributor to the whole. So you count. Each person individually is only a part, but we contribute to the whole. So that's the bridge from book to book, is the importance of each individual one. And you'll see how that leads into our first mitzvah of the book. Now, now that I'm listening to Rabbi Rosner, I'm learning all kinds of different things. He's fascinating. Anyway, so here is the first sentence of the book, which is not usually a sentence that we see. Seder Rishon Ein Ba Mitzvot L'Cheshboneinu. Right? So we're starting. The first parsha in the book of Bamidbar is... What's the name of the first parsha? No. Everybody should know this. Right. Thank you. The first parsha is always the name of the book, right? So it says, Seder Rishon, the first parsha of this book, there are no mitzvot, there's not a mitzvah, according to our account. What does that mean? According to somebody else's count,
there is
one.
Right.
Okay, so he's just making it clear, according to our count, there's not. And the Rambam goes into this. This is a very interesting piece that the Rambam goes into. So the Rambam discusses in his Sefer HaMitzvot, how do you know if it's a mitzvah? Right, which is not something that we did, not something that I'm yet ready to do, but there is, the Rambam does discuss, how do you know when it says, and God said to the children of Israel, do whatever, how do you know that's one of the 613 or not? Right? So one way that you know is, does it apply forever? If it's just in that time, it is not one of the 613. So if it says, go to war and wipe out this nation in your neighborhood, that is not a mitzvah forever. It does not mean we should be violent forever. It means that's a specific mitzvah for that specific time and doesn't count for now. Like, for instance, don't leave your house the night of the Seder, right? That's a mitzvah, but only in Egypt, only at that time. That mitzvah does not apply today, so it is not one of the 613 counts.
So it's perpetual.
Only perpetual mitzvahs count. So noheg ledorot. So I wrote that there. Noheg ledorot is behaved for the generations. I noticed walking into the JCC, it said the production of from door to door will be performed without intermission. And I say, why did they spell it D-O-O-R? That's a door of the building.
Yeah, no, as opposed to
door. I saw it. It's part of the play.
Uh-huh, and that's a double entendre.
But it's a double entendre because it is generational, but it's also part of the play.
Uh-huh, because door, usually in English, when we write door meaning generation,
D-O-R.
It's D-O-R.
D-O-R.
Right. Yeah. And then I was wondering, just because my brain is that way, why don't we say door? Why is it door? Like, how do the two O's work in the word door? That doesn't make any sense. It should be D-O-R anyway. Anyway. That's my thought walking up the stairs.
Otherwise, it would be Dur.
Dur, right.
Dur.
It's weird. Right. Why do we have that? Why is it spelled that way?
Never thought about that.
English. A language that's hard to understand. So it's the concept of noheg ledorot. Noheg is the same root as minhag, right? Nahag. Nahag is a driver of a bus, right? In modern Hebrew, it's the nahag. And you'll hear people in Israel say, nahag, nahag, you know, open the back door. So that's, but lean hog or min hag or no hag all has to do with behavior. Like the nahag behaves the bus, right? Makes the bus go. So if it's no hag ledorot, if it's a perpetual behavior, then it's one of the 613. So the Rambam says many have erred in this count. And so that's referring to the statement in 4:12, chapter 4, verse 4:15, chapter 4, verse 15, which the Bahag, a different counter of the mitzvot, counts as a mitzvah, because he learns from it a perpetual mitzvah. But it's actually, according to the Rambam and according to Sefer Chinuch, that particular mitzvah of covering certain things is only a mitzvah in that time, so it doesn't count. So we're not counting that mitzvah.
So this Bahag has a different number than.
Yes.
Then does the Rambam subscribe to 613?
Everybody agrees to 613.
Just which?
Everybody agrees to 613.
That's
not a question.
The number is set.
The number is set. The question is, which ones are they?
How do they count?
Right. So there are some differences. So there's mostly overlap. I would be curious to know how many are the differences amongst the different counts. I don't know that.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
It would be interesting to know.
What's the 415 right there?
That's the verse. I'll tell you what that verse is. It did bring my information.
Is it in Bamidbar?
In Bamidbar. So that's in the first parasha, right? So that's the mitzvah that's not in our count. When then Aaron and his sons had completed the covering of the sanctuary and all the vessels of the sanctuary, the breaking up of the camp, only after that did the sons of Kahat come in to carry, so that none should touch the sanctuary and die. These formed the burden of the sons of Kahat in the tent of the appointed meeting. So the Bahag says, covering up the vessels of the sanctuary before moving them is one of the 613, and he applies it to something later on.
That makes it perpetual.
That makes it, well, that makes it apply today, but it's not, actually. That's learned out of that. That particular sentence does only apply to then, even if you're pulling something, like you have to be careful with covering things or touching things or whatever it is. Today, it's not a perpetual mitzvah. So that's...
You only have to do it at that one time.
Well, when you have a sanctuary.
So if we...
When we'll have a sanctuary. Yeah, that only has to do with the tabernacle. No, that has to do with the tabernacle in the desert, right? Which we're not going to have again. Right. Now, interestingly, and I'll just bring this again. I did not see this inside, but it's worth it just to think about. The Rambam says, why is that? Why does it have to be a perpetual mitzvah for it to be one of our 613 count? So this, in a very un-Rambam-like fashion, he reports this, quotes this concept. He's usually a rationalist and doesn't usually go into this, but I guess this is broadly accepted enough in a Kabbalistic sense that even he says it. So we know that we have 248 positive commandments and 365 negative commandments. Each one of the commandments is related to a part of our body. And so our bodies yearn for their expression. Each part of our body yearns to be expressed through a mitzvah. So So that's what the Rambam says, that you wake up in the morning and the body is, each part is calling, please express me through this. And if it wouldn't be a perpetual commandment, if you would count one of the 613 as something that can never, ever be done again, so what? Your little pinky is supposed to forever be frustrated that it could never, ever access that mitzvah? Or that there should be the possibility, right? So that's very un-Rambam-like to discuss things this way.
All right, having said that, mm-hmm. we think about the number of mitzvot that can only be performed either in the land of Israel, knowing that we basically have spent a lot of our time outside the land, and or only when the temple is existent. And
or only by males, or only by females. But there is that connection together, and there is the hope that it will be restored. So all the 613 are ones that we are connected into each other. Nobody can keep all 613 themselves, even if they are even all. Even if our little pinky does call for a mitzvah that applies only to judges, and none of us are judges, but we're related by klalness, by collective relationship, to somebody who is.
So yearn to do it.
Well, so we're related to somebody who can express it. And so it is expressed, our body is expressed through them. We are connected to each other. You know, so this concept is very strong. Our peoplehood is different than any other concept of any other peoplehood. We are related, and we do make a difference in each other's lives, for good and for bad. So there is no such thing as you get to do something in a vacuum. It doesn't happen. Everything you do affects the Jewish people, for good or for bad. And everything another Jew does affects you. So it behooves us to recognize our collectivity and to relate to each other as part of the collective whole and in a positive way, so that collectively we all pull together and are on the same page, if possible, or at least in the same chapter.
Why are we our own worst enemies?
Right. Why are we? We really are.
I know.
Yeah, it's a sad thing. And, you know, that's a hump that we still have to climb over as part of our collective peoplehood. You know, there's a lot that we need to accomplish. So each generation has its own challenges. You know, like this generation's challenge is not keeping Shabbos. It's a piece of cake for anybody who wants to. Nobody will go hungry who keeps Shabbos, and nobody will be fired who keeps Shabbos. So you might feel a little uncomfortable in your social group, or it might restrict what you want to do, but nobody, it's not this generation's hurdle in that sense, which it was 150 years ago. People lost their job time after time, week after week, and people literally went hungry to keep Shabbos. So that's not it today. So that's not our, so that was something that we had to get over as a nation. Today, one of our challenges is screens, right, is wealth. We never had a Jewish people who had this much money and could make this amount of choices of what to do with their time and with what to do with their stuff and try to focus it towards holiness. We never had this challenge before in the history of the Jewish people. It's our challenge. So, but part of our collective multi-generational challenge is learning how to work together. And in no generation have we yet accomplished that. So while we have each challenges of each generation, we also have collective challenges of generations, and one of them is unity. We haven't gotten there, but it is definitely on our list. Just must not be very high up yet. We just have to get to a place where it's higher than that. It's interesting because my husband recently davened in a shul where the person who is davening from the Amid does not daven well. They mispronounce words and garble their speech and kind of quiet. And my husband's wondering, like, he said, according to the Shulchan Aruch, from what I've learned, that type of davening is not permitted. So I said, so why does that synagogue allow that person to daven on a regular basis? Because it's on a regular basis. So we talked about different reasons, and we said, perhaps this is a case where, even though the Shulchan Aruch says that it's more of a recommendation than a straight halacha, you won't satisfy your requirements if that person leads. It's just better, somebody like that. Where in this case, the collective congregation says that person's honor and respect is more important than that halacha. And so we have that person, daven.
So daven like leading the services.
Leading the services, leading them.
Either that or he's very rich.
Right. Right.
Is this okay?
Oh, so that's what that's the question.
That's
is it okay or not? And it seems that in this...
What is more important, to honor somebody? Or?
Right, so I think it's different case by case, but in this case there is somebody that's a halachic authority in that midst who must at least acquiesce, if not proactively, you know, allow that situation to continue. There was a time when, in a different congregation, my husband asked if somebody davened with just a terrible voice. Very old person, in his later 80s. And so he went to the... He said, I don't understand how this person's davening. And somebody said, do you know who that person is? He said, that person, his name was Chazen Tevlovitz, Alav Hashalom. Chazen Tevlovitz, yeah, he had a beautiful voice when he was younger. He does not have a good voice now.
And that happens.
Yeah, he does not have... It's true. He said, however, he lives near Mount Sinai Hospital, and he used to house a lot of people who were there for treatments over Shabbos, so much so that they were bursting at the seams. So Satmar Biker Holim, which takes care of a lot of sick people, bought the apartment next door to him and paid to have the wall broken down so he would have extra bedrooms so that he and his wife could host all those people they needed hosting. And every Shabbos, they hosted whoever needed hosting. And if anybody in the hospital ever died, he would be the one who would answer the phone and he would go sit with them until after Shabbos. Right? Said, who else do you want leading your prayers, really?
You know? I think somebody's listening to him.
Right, exactly. It's like, who cares what his voice sounds like? That's who you want at the head of the congregation.
But sometimes you don't even know if there's something... I met a little boy this weekend who has had 123 surgeries on his vocal cords.
Oh, my gosh.
Over the past 10 years. And I've actually known who he is for 10 years because I do a fundraiser every year for the Ronald McDonald House for the children there. And he was telling me, he's like, I mean, you have to, like, lean really close. You can barely hear him. And he said, you know, Taya, I think I can't do your surgery. And if he doesn't do the surgeries, he basically will suffocate himself.
Wow.
And so his voice, for all intents and purposes, is gone. But his heart, I know.
Right. How many surgeries? I hear that. Mm-hmm. Can you do?
How many can you
do? Okay. Now let's start with this mitzvah. Mitzvah 362, the first one in Sefer Bamidbar. The precept of sending the ritually unclean outside the camp of the Shechina. So now that we've established the camp, right? We've counted the people, we know who are the tribes, we've set up the camp, we've set up the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the desert, in the book of Shemot, Exodus. And now we have the people all set up, how they're supposed to go and carry and do and all that stuff. So now we have this concept of who's allowed in and who's excluded from. Right? So the first mitzvah is sending the ritually unclean outside the camp. So this mitzvah, the pasuk says, Tzav et b'nei Yisrael v'yishlechu min ha-machaneh kol tzeroa v'chol zav v'chol tamei l'nefesh. Right, command the Israelites that they should put out of the camp everyone afflicted with tzarat, and everyone with a discharge, and everyone unclean through the dead. So three different types have to be put out of the camp. And who is this mitzvah given to? Not the Kohanim, not the leaders, all of us.
Yeah.
Right. So it shouldn't be that one of us goes to somebody and says, you know, so-and-so is really doing things and you should fix them. No, it's all of our job. You know, we're all commanded with this, that all of us are required to remove negativity from our midst. So who are these three groups? anybody who has any, and I'm just noticing on your face possibly, anybody who has any New Testament familiarity is thinking about the poor lepers that were constantly excluded and all that stuff. So that is based on this, but it's not. So you have to completely erase that, completely, and understand it from a Jewish perspective. Okay, so what's going on? It is not excluding the sick and afflicted at all whatsoever. The only way you can get tzaras, which is a physical manifestation of a spiritual malady, is by doing a sin. You can't get it other than by committing the avera of speaking negatively about somebody else. When you do that, you could get this affliction. There is no other way to get it. It's not just a physical thing. You don't just catch it. It's not contagious, unless it's contagious to speak gossip, which it is. But when you gossip against another, what you do is, through your language, separate that person out of the collective whole and make them look negative. You create a negative bubble around them and try to separate them from the integration of everyone. So the treatment for you, not the revenge, but the treatment is a taste of your own medicine. Oh, you want to try to separate another person? See what it feels like physically to be separated. Go outside the camp and take a break from being part of the community and see what it's like to be all alone and see if that's what you want to do to somebody else or not. Do some tshuva. Realize you should be part of it. Once you do proper tshuva and wait 7 days, then you're re-examined by the Kohen who looks at your skin or whatever the manifestation is of that disease and says, oh, looks like you've done proper tshuva. Now you can go to the mikvah and rejoin. It is completely a spiritual thing. It has nothing to do with physical sickness at all whatsoever. But it is manifested physically. So it is, for Tzarat, it's that person's fault, 100%. And so they need that treatment. That person, a mitzora, has to be excluded completely from the entire camp. So now let's look at the three. I made a little chart because there's all kinds of things here, right? So there's three different kinds of tumah that are discussed in this verse. A tamei mate, that's the tumah from a dead body. So you can look at your chart here. The tumah from being connected with a dead body. We'll see how far that person has to be excluded. Azav, someone that has something issue from their body. Tumah hayotze migufo. So that's either that can be a type of issue. Usually, that comes from the sexual organs. That's a negative flow of something. That's not periods and not babies, something else that can happen to males or females that would make a man called a zav, be called a zav, or a female be called a zava, or a nida, or a yoledet, or a woman who has her period, or someone who just gave birth. All three of those flows have to do with a life force exiting the body. All tuma has to do with a death connection, as we've discussed before, which we'll discuss a little bit more. So
Zav is Nida or not?
No. Zav is including these three things. Any kind, the category is Tuma Hayotze Migufo, any kind of Tuma that comes out of the body. So that would be Zav or Nida or Yoledet.
Okay.
All three of those
are
Tuma that you can tell because there's been a flow.
Right, okay.
Some type of a flow. Right? So mate, you came in contact with a dead body. Zav is the flow. And Mitzora is Lashon Hara. Kind of tuma. From where do they have to be excluded, right? So there's three different camps. Here in our mitzvah, we're talking about Machane Shechina, the camp of the Shechina. But it turns out there's really, so that's God's special place. So that would be the Ohel Moed or the Mishkan or the center of the camp. Surrounding where the Aron is, because that's, so right next to where it is in the desert, I wrote the defining quality. How do you know where this machane is? This camp, machane means camp. Okay, how do you know where this machane is? It has the Aron in it. It has the Aron Kodesh, where the tablets of the covenant are. So that's wherever that is, that around, right around that is called the Machane Shechina. Surrounding the Aron, so the next layer of the camp is the Machane Leviya, the Levitical camp, whether it's all Levites or not, but that's called the Machane Leviya. And surrounding that is called the Machane Yisrael, the rest of the Jews' camp. Right, so in the desert, it was concentric circles. There is where the Aron is, they're surrounding the Aron, and then they're surrounding that. So there's three different areas, which we'll talk about in a minute. Today, how does that, what are the parallels today? Because that's in the desert. Now today meaning in a functioning today, so when we have our temple, right? So inside the Azara, so that's inside the it's not the Holy of Holies. It's an area close. I wish I should have brought the map. But inside the holier part of the temple, there's different areas inside the temple. So inside that, that's called the Machane Shechina.
So is that like the Kotel Plaza, maybe?
Hang on.
Okay.
We will get there.
All right.
So the answer is no, but we'll get there, okay? Machane Leviya is compared to Har Habayit, okay, the top of the Temple Mount.
It's hard to get to anywhere these days.
And the question is, what's with the Kotel itself, which is part of Har Habayit, right? The Temple the Kotel Plaza is the city of Jerusalem and out. From the outside of the Kotel to the rest of Jerusalem is the city of Jerusalem. Okay, so that's the third area.
So the plaza is the equivalent of the city of Jerusalem.
Yes, is the beginning of the city of Jerusalem.
So, The Har HaBayit would be the wall itself, maybe?
Har HaBayit is the Temple Mount, and it would maybe possibly include the wall. Because that's part of the Temple Mount.
Yeah, it is. That's the support for it.
Right, so we will see how that applies, okay? So, let's leave the third, the last bar for a minute, the last column. Okay, so we see these three camps, Machane Shechina, Machane Levia, which is Har HaBayit today, Machane Yisrael, which is further out. From which one does each of these three Tamei people need to be excluded? So the Metzora has to be excluded from the Jewish people altogether for a limited period of time. They go out all the way. You would think maybe a Tamei mate should be the most excluded, because we've talked about before how they're the most Tamei. But in this case, they're the least Tamei of these three.
Hmm.
They're not more Tamei than Anita, which is less Tamei, but the way that the Tuma is transferred is less. So the parts that they can have access to is different. So Metzora all the way out, Azav, so that's any one of these kinds of flows, male or female, they can be in Jerusalem,
just
they can live there, but they can't go to the Har HaBayit. Somebody who's Tamei mate can actually go on Har HaBayit today.
They just can't go.
But they can't go
into the
Azara, wherever that is, and we're not sure where that is exactly. So we have
stay sort of away just to be safe.
Yes.
Maybe it's dependent on what you have actual control over. I mean, sometimes you might not have control over being...
Right, you don't, which is fine.
Yeah.
It's not so terrible to be Tamei.
Right.
And you're not, so that's what I'm saying. These Azav, Nida, Yolet, you just gave birth, you had your period, you don't have a control over that, really. So you're not excluded from the people of Israel, you just can't go to the temple. That's it, right? But you stay in Jerusalem, you're not excluded from peoplehood.
Right.
Whereas the Metzora is excluded from peoplehood. You're part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
You're in. Nobody has to not talk to you. Metzora is very difficult because people don't even talk to you during that time. It's a really hard...
It's isolating.
It's isolation. It's a difficult thing to go through. That's not the case at all for anybody else who is Tamei. And a Tamei mate, somebody who came into contact with a dead body, whether they're an undertaker, whether they're on the Chavar Kadisha, whether they're a grave digger, whether they're a soldier in a war, you know, whether they're a doctor...
Some of those people would always be Tamei mate as long as, I mean...
Right. So that it's not terrible to be Tamei mate. A Kohen is not permitted to be Tamei mate because they have service they have to do in the temple. They're not permitted to become Tamei mate. But the rest of us are. It's not really a problem. We can walk around all day long being Tamei mate. It's a problem, however, for you want to bring the Korban Pesach. Okay, now you have to pay attention to how Tamei you are, and you have to think about it. It does take 7 days plus a certain ceremony to get out of that Tumah. So before Passover, you'd want to make sure that you go through that whole thing so that you can bring the Korban. I'm not sure if the halacha is about eating the Korban Pesach of your Tamei mate. I think you might still be able to eat it if you're Tamei mate. You just can't bring it if you're Tamei mate.
So what about I remember something about cooking for women. Is that also...
No, that would be superstition. That women who are having their period or something should cook. No, that's complete superstition and it's not Jewish at all.
Well,
it may be there, but it's not...
Isn't that where she got the idea? Because you're talking about an actual physical camp with tents that are in concentric circles. Is that what you're talking about? Where did
originally.
Oh, yeah. In the desert. They have to go out.
So that's like the red tent with Anita Dunn.
No, it's not at all.
Well,
that's complete
sheker. But maybe
the complete and 100%. There's nothing like it. No.
Got that? No.
No. Absolutely not. Forget it. Absolutely not. Not at all whatsoever. There's no such thing, right? So there just was never anything like that, ever. It's a complete lie and made up Chilul Hashem. That book is one page after another of complete Chilul Hashem. It's so important to know that. There's almost nothing true in that book.
All right, okay.
Let's all breathe.
Let's deep breath.
There's never anything like that ever in the history of the Jewish people. Okay.
Right, that being said,
that
where
being
do
said,
they go?
Okay. This is
they don't have
about
to go the, anywhere.
This is right. They don't have to go anywhere. They stay in their own home with their own husband and sleep right next to him in their
and
very
their
own
meals.
Bed and cook their meals and serve them.
They just can't
so
touch.
No.
Right. Just
they
the
just
husband
can't
and
touch.
Wife can't touch each other. That's it.
No touching, but
right.
So, Aliza, now women who pray at the wall.
Yeah.
Since it's outside, they can go
yes.
even when they have period.
Absolutely. Yep. 100%. Right.
Well, that wall is not part of that.
Well, so there's
well,
a
that's
question.
A question. She was
we're going to look
question,
at that question for just
sort
a second.
Of could be part of the support
yeah,
of the
yeah.
Temple Mount.
We'll look at the question in just a minute.
Outside of the Temple Mount.
Well, we're going to look at it in just a second, okay? So in the desert times, when you're talking about tents, they still didn't have to leave their tent. I don't know what would, I mean, where everybody's living, but they're talking about the area of operation, really. So they're not, they don't have to leave their home for this. The Metzora does have to leave their home, but nobody else has to leave their home for this.
So why do they have these three different camps?
That's how the whole
nation was set up in the desert.
Right, and it's interesting. Yeah, that's how the nation was set up in the desert. And it's interesting, what Rav Hirsch has a whole introduction, a little introduction to Sefer Bemidbar, and it really talks about the counting of the people and seeing who counts and what, who can be relied upon, who pitches in with their half a shekel to say, yes, count me in, I'm part of this project. Is that a political thing that says, no, you're in the desert? It can't even be political. It really is about functioning as the people of God on the planet, who we are and how we count, because it's not about getting ready for a war or dealing with other nations, because we're in the desert in the middle of nowhere with no one around us. It's not, has nothing to do with our interactions with others yet at this time or anything like that. It's just all about us, our own organization. This is about our own organization. Where are we holding? So with that, let's look at the allegorical thing that the Shlach HaKodesh talks about also, because it's about physical and it's also about allegorical. So the Shlach, I wrote down here, under here, Shlach HaKodesh, that's how he's called. His name is Meir Lublin, or Meir Ben Gedalia. He lived 1558 to 1616. And he wrote, one of the books that he wrote, his most, I guess, remembered book, is called the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, the Two Tablets of the Covenant. And if you take the beginning of each one of those things, the Shnei, the SH, and the L, and the H, you get Shlach. Right? So he's called the Shlach after his book, the Shnei Luchot HaBrit. And since he's famous and holy, and everybody likes him now in the hindsight of history, so he's called the Shlach HaKodesh, the holy Shlach. Right? We like him. So what does the Shlach say? He says this is a much deeper allegorical idea in addition to the physical idea, right? So what do we have to do? We have to keep Tuma out of our camps. What are the camps that each one of us individually have? So the top camp, which would be equal to the Machane Shechina, is our head, right? That's the holiest part, is our connection to God with our heads and what goes on in our heads. So from our head, our thoughts, we should keep out any thoughts, try our very best to keep away thoughts of sin. Here, hooray, Avera. That's not plans even, that's fleeting thoughts, right? So fleeting thoughts are different than the next level, which is our emotions. That's getting into desires. You're actually working on it. You really want it. You're thinking about it.
That's a Levia.
Right, that's a Levia, right? That we should stay out of the Machane Levia is our emotions. That's the next realm. And the third one, Machane Yisrael, is our actions. Certainly we don't want any negativity in our actions, but if we could chase it far away from us, so first we chase it out of our actions, then we chase it out of our emotions, then we chase it out of our heads, but really this negativity, negative thoughts about sins and transgressing should be far from us, and we should chase it far from us. That's part of what he says is the deeper aspect of this mitzvah, is chase this tumah. What is tumah? Tumah is disconnectivity. So chase the disconnectivity as far away from you as you can. That's why it all has to do with death. All death is disconnected from potential, right? So we all have potential to grow as long as we're alive. And there's different levels of potential depending on where we're holding and what we're doing, what we're engaged in, what we're immersed in, with death being the closing of the door of all potential. So that's why we usually look at Tamei Meit as the lowest level, the most Tamei possible. Because there's no possibility of connecting.
The thing over you.
However, a Metzora also is disconnected, because you can't keep mitzvahs in a vacuum. Once you separate yourself from the congregation of Israel with that kind of language and that kind of, like, I could say what I want to say and be nasty and mean to somebody else. Once you do that, you've taken yourself out of the context of the collective group of people who are working according to God's plan. So that also is closing of a door, right? So that is connected to death. Well, that's when we say there are dead people who are considered still alive. Let's say the author of this book is talking to us today. He's dead and he's still alive in our lives. He's affecting us. The Rambam and the Ramchal, the people that we learn from in this class, even if they're dead, they're still alive. But we also, our sages teach us that there are alive people who are considered dead. You know, people who, even if they look so alive, they've surrounded themselves with whatever. Their whole goal in life is just to make money, spend money, enjoy the stuff that money buys, and they're not seeking anything greater than themselves at all whatsoever. They might as well be dead. There's nothing to them. Not that you can't enjoy nice things, but I'm saying for a person who's only that, they're dead. There's nothing there that's connecting them to anything alive. So a Metzora has a breath of death in them because they've disconnected so clearly from the people. They can reconnect. They're lucky their bodies are still alive. They can connect back in. But that is required, that level of tshuva, to connect back in.
Wait, so, I'm sorry to harp on this, but I'm just trying to get a mental picture in my head.
Right.
This.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that what was set up like in the desert where the Aron was in the middle and the four tribes were... the four corners were divided by the, mm-hmm. the three tribes. So are you looking at these concentric rings around the camp as kind of the...
I think these are in the middle.
I think this is ring one.
Right. One, two, three.
Okay.
So the Metzora goes out here. Mm-hmm. Metzora. They have to go outside. This is Yisrael. This is Livia. And this is Shechina. Shechina.
Okay.
So the question is, you're right, I don't know exactly what is
where
it like inside this.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody lives here.
Right, right.
Right, so who's living here and what's the story with that? And there's probably different zones even inside this, how close you can get. That's my guess, is that there's the living quarters of this belt and the functioning quarters of this belt.
Well, and you would think about that if you would think about it from a desert point of view, that's how you would organize anyway, because you, and maybe even where they kept the animals were even in the outer circle or whatever, because of how you have to sort of structure your lives.
Studying the Talmud, and we were going through a place with the Gemara study about, you know, where you do the Shema and when you do the Shema, and one of the things where you had to go in order to have bowel movement, you had to go out of the camp. You could not be within the sanctity of the camp to have elimination. So where did they go?
Probably to four.
Camp.
Right. You don't go near your tent.
Right. 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 Or somebody else's tent.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
Right. So you go out. Yeah. Yeah. So you do go out. So, and there's a place outside. They're not just cast to the wolves.
Right. There's like little communities or something.
I don't know if there's communities.
Well, but designated.
There's got to be something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they're cast alone, but I don't know exactly what it's like. It's a very good question. What would it be physically like? And we are supposed to wonder those things, so that's a good question. What was it actually like?
You know, I was thinking about, because we just took a road trip. Mm-hmm. We drove from here to Santa Fe, and there are places where it's really, you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's really true.
And then, I kept thinking about it. It just reminded me some parts of Israel, it just looks like that. You know, you have hills, and then there is a desert, and there is nothing, just earth, no trees, nothing.
Right.
And I thought about it, just...
Right. Right.
40 years.
I know, I drove like that too, and I thought about the stagecoaches, you know, like, this is where they were attacked, in this place right here, where there's nobody around, you know.
Right.
And how vulnerable you are out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there is that vulnerability, and that's one reason why the Torah was given in the desert. You're in the middle of nowhere. Nobody claims that ground. You know, it doesn't belong to anyone. It doesn't have its own national feeling or minhagim of its own. It's empty and waiting for somebody else to put something into it. Unlike Denver, which is different than Cheyenne, which is different than Portland, which is different than Taos. Each community has its flavor. You know, Denver and Boulder, they're right next to each other, but they're a very different feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So so the desert's empty. It doesn't have its own feeling. It doesn't have its own sense. So you put in it what you want. That's why the Torah was given in the desert. That's why we spent some time in the desert, so we could cultivate our own culture. and so that we would have something to bring into the land of Israel, because in the land of Israel, where there were groups that needed to be supplanted, we had to chase away the culture that was there and put in the culture that we developed in the desert. So the desert was a place of proactive cultural development, right? And those who are not on the program of that proactive cultural development, out, right? So that's the Mitzorah. It's only the Mitzorah. Out with you. And the other ones,
it's
all
permanent.
About...
I think not, that, see, I think that's right. The really...
is not permanent.
None of these are really permanent.
No, none of them are. Well, the Mitzorah could be permanent if he chooses not to do tshuva.
Well,
that's up to him.
Right.
But likely the pressure will be brought to bear that he will do tshuva and want to rejoin the camp. Right? And that's really what tshuva is returning
to. Be out of the camp.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, to be out of the camp in the desert.
Out of the camp in the wilderness.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course
you would. Not so pleasant. Okay, you have your...
So you don't get your mana. You don't get your mana.
Blend in with somebody else.
Right. Right. So, okay, so we have this concept as you're familiar with. We're all about life, not death. We're not a death-celebrating religion. We're a life-celebrating religion. So on this next page, I put choose life. We do celebrate Yahrzeits rather than birthdays. We're not a birthday-celebrating culture. You know, we American Jews do celebrate birthdays because we live in America, but it's not Jewish to celebrate birthdays, really. Jewishly, there is sometimes pause, introspection for a birthday, but it's not like a celebrate you time. But we do mark the yard sites of those who have passed. Why? We're not celebrating their death.
Their life,
right? The yard site, a birthday is all about potential. Where can you go from here? The yard site says, where did you get? And now you can measure. Once the person's gone, you can say, oh, this is what they achieved. Now, not that we always know what they achieved, but the point is there's no more potential, so now you can measure something. Now you can look back
and
see.
It would be sort of Jewish to measure potential, I would think.
Well, you can't measure potential either. How long are you going
to
live?
True, but right? To anticipate
So that's why a birthday is a time of brachas.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You can give a bracha or you receive a bracha on your birthday that it should be about maximizing potential.
Right. Yeah, that's
so
nice.
It is a day of potential, recognizing potential and trying to, you know, increase right. that potential, move forward with potential. And then he brings brings this pasuk. Let's see, on page 7, this matter can be likened by way of parable to the royal palace of a king, from which every man who is ill with tzarat or loathsome in his body or even in his clothes is kept well removed. It is in keeping with the verse, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth, from Esther. Right, so that's this pasuk. You probably remember it in Hebrew. Those of you who have listened to the Megillah, ki ein lavo el shar hamelech belevush sak. Right, so Mordechai was sent clothes by Esther to change his clothing. He's wearing sackcloth, sak in Hebrew. He's wearing sackcloth because he's in mourning at the gates of the palace because he's heard the evil decree. And Esther says, no, you've got to change your clothes because you can't be in the gates of the palace in sackcloth. You're going to come in. You have to look like a mensch. So choose life, right? Sackcloth is about death. So you can't be death-related if you want to come into God's presence. That verse, right? You can't come to the gates of the king in sackcloth. Choose life. Right, move into the life potential direction rather into the death disconnected direction. Okay, and then there's a halacha, and I don't think it's in here. I think just Rabbi Rosner brought it, but it's interesting to think about outside of all walled cities, not Jerusalem. So Jerusalem, what's the story of... Jerusalem is the only official one that they have to leave. But there is, during the temple times and times when we're more careful in Tuma and Tara, there may also be the halacha that you have to leave a walled city if you're a Mitzorah, not anybody else. But so a walled city, Jericho, I think Akko, I think Tiberia. There's a few different cities in Israel that were walled. It could be any walled city altogether in the land of Israel, or just the ones that are walled from the days of Yoshua ben Nun, the ones that we can tell by... Purim celebrations. There's different days for celebrating Purim depending on if you're in a walled city or not a walled city, even if there's no wall today. But what is the concept of a walled city? So I thought this was interesting. I had never heard this before. A walled city represents the fortification of the people who were there before us, right? They walled the city. Yehoshua ben Nun is the one who brought us into the land of Israel. So when we met Jericho, the city, it was walled already. We didn't wall it. It was walled by the people who were there. So the walled city represents the fortifications, the strength, the might of the people that we conquered. If we came in and we breached their wall and took that city, it represents the fact that God helped us take that over. It's not a sign of our strength physically. It's a sign of our strength spiritually, because we're not so strong physically. We know that about us, looking at the Jewish people. We're not physically a strong people. So if we could overcome their wall, that means we had the siyata d'shmaya, we had the heavenly assistance necessary to overcome their physical strength with our spiritual strength. So it shows a spiritual triumph. So in a place that has a special remembrance of the spiritual triumph of the Jews, from that place we would also exclude the Metzora, right? That he or she would also be out of that. Okay, let's just go. Wait, do we want to put that here or there? Okay, good. We'll do about going up to Har HaBayit in this one. Okay. So now, mitzvah 3. Oh my goodness. Crazy clock.
Yeah.
Okay, quick. I guess we'll save Vidui for the next time. We'll just do this mitzvah. So this is the negative of the positive. 362 is that we should put out any ritually defiled person. Here is a ritually defiled person should not enter. So mitzvah 362 is on the klal. It's our job to exclude them. This is on the person. It's their job not to enter. Okay? So they're not permitted to enter. Now, they're not permitted to enter anywhere in the sanctuary. So we have this concept, and this is not about the other parts of the city. This is just about the sanctuary area, okay? So we have this phrase, Kedusha Tumat Mikdash V'Kadshav, Kasher Tumat Mikdash V'Kadshav Mikol Averot B'Torah. It's more difficult, the Tumah of the Mikdash and its Kadosh things from all other Averas in the Torah. So what does that mean? That means, and what I can't even say
reading?
What that means. I'm reading from this paper that I gave you. More difficult is the Tumah of the Mikdash and its holy things than all the other Averas in the Torah. How do we know that? Because of the way we do tshuva for it, the kind of kapara. We offer one se'ir. I think a se'ir is a cow, but I didn't check carefully. One se'ir versus 32 se'irim, or one time period versus every month. So every month we offer multiple karbanot to atone for the fact that we collectively have defiled the sanctity of the temple and its holy things. That's every month, multiple offerings, month after month after month, which shows that this is a very big avera, as opposed to when one of us does another avera, even a big one in the Torah. We bring one offering and say sorry, and we're done. So you can tell by how you have to repair the damage that the damage done from defiling the holiness of the temple and its holy things is a much greater sin than many other sins. So what does that mean? So here we have to be extremely careful. We're not going to go into some of this stuff. Let's see. Okay. The question is, how tamei do you have to be before you get punished, or how tamei does the thing have to be so that goes in? Can you throw in a tamei kli, a tamei vessel? Let's say you are tamei meat and you're playing, I don't know, baseball with somebody, right? So you've touched that baseball now. The baseball is tamei, right? And now, on purpose, you toss it over the wall of the temple. So you're tamei meat, so that means that your tumah is contagious. You've touched something and made it contagious. Although, as we talked about another time when we talked about different tumahs, it goes down a level every time it's caught from the next one. It goes down. But you throw that tummy thing into the Beit HaMikdash, you have defiled the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it's not that it can't function, but you've done an Avera. So the question is, what's the Avera? If you're tummy mate and you go in where you're not supposed to be, karet, spiritual excision. If you're a tummy mate and you make something tummy and you throw it over, just lashes. Right? You did defile, but you don't get karet for that. You didn't go in, but you tossed something in. Right. So now the question is, okay, so now we see how strong it is. That's for our practical talk about going on to the Temple Mount or touching the Kotel, which is part of the Temple Mount, okay? So again, check with your own halachic authority before you attempt this on your own. But in general, today we are very careful not to go on the Temple Mount at all because we don't know where the Holy Center is. And it says in the end of this, where it says, to whom does it apply? Right, on page 13, just this last verse, it says, and I will make desolate your sanctuaries, which means even when it's desolate, it's still a sanctuary. The sanctuary-ness, the quality of sanctuary, the quality of kadosh doesn't disappear just because it's been destroyed. So God says, I'm going to destroy it, but it will still be holy. Don't even think of walking there if you're tameh mate or any of the other tumas, right? So that for that reason, we do have a general idea, sort of where it is. So there are people who, after they've gone to the mikvah to remove any of these other tumas, zav, or nida, or yoledet, or even metzora, or different tumas that people have that would make them so that they can't go onto the Temple Mount, a religious person who wants to go on the Temple Mount would go to the mikvah, and then they could go. They're still tamei mate. That doesn't take away the tamei mateness of them. But they could go around the outside edges. So you could maybe go up there with your small group on the outside edge. But we're not allowed to go anywhere towards the middle. Now the question is, what does going in mean? Right? So this is a question that's asked in a lot of different things. Certainly it's asked sexually, and it even uses a language like this. It says, what is bia, going in? Right? And we use that word to mean the sexual act too. What does going in mean? At what point have you transgressed? How far in do you have to be before you've crossed the line? Right? So here it's talking about how far in the temple. So what if you put your arm in your tummy mate, but your whole body's not in? Well, you can't do that. Right? That is transgressing. Do you get karit for that? Lashes for that? I think you get lashes for that, not karit for that. Because you're not all the way in, but you put your arm in. You can't enter the space. What about if it's a hand? What about if it's a finger? So it seems that a finger might be okay, which is why those who are very stringent and hold that the wall of the kotel is part of the holiness, could you put your finger in to put a note in the wall? Those who are stringent say, no, you cannot, and they won't put a note in. Mm-hmm. But there are those who hold that it's not actually an entry. You can't go in through the stones. Like, how far in are you going? It's not actually an opening.
Just touching.
So you are going past the outside wall by putting your finger in, but you couldn't step inside that. There's not a way. It's not an entryway. So then it's not. So there are those who hold that it's not, and that's how we basically hold as a group today. We do put a note in the wall and touch the wall and touch the inside of the crevices. But there would be those who would hold, it's too close to holiness, so Rav Kook's father held that way, the Aderet, I don't know what his name was, but he held that way. So there are those who hold, no, you can't get, no, don't go that close. But in general, the way that we hold today is you could get that close, even if you're tameh mate. And certainly you could be in the Kotel Plaza today as a tameh mate, or other kind of tameh, right? None of us, even though I'm guessing all of us, certainly myself, even though I speak way too much Lashon Hara, and in temple times would be covered with tzaraas and be kicked completely out of the camp. We'd be having a big tzaraas party outside the camp, right? Hopefully we will get our acts together, but even though that's the case, we don't actually have tzaraas and we don't have that din, we don't have that judgment on us because there's no kohen to rule it for us. So it does require that too.
Really
it requires the sin, it requires the physical manifestation of the sin, and it requires the evaluation and judgment of a kohen to put somebody into that position. So you can't just because you speak Lashon Hara doesn't mean you're now excluded from the whole thing. But we should learn from it that we would be, and so we should be more careful about what it is because it does disconnect us from the potential of the whole thing. So we'll end on that today. Yes, ask a question.
How significant is it to walk away from the wall?
Backwards.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to, but it is considered a sign of respect. But it's not actually holy in of itself because it is just the wall of the dirt of the hill of the temple. But it's part of building in ourselves the consciousness of the awesomeness of the place. So we don't actually have the place to show awe towards, so we kind of transfer it here. Some people would say it's mistransferred and we shouldn't be doing it, that it even borders on a Vodazara, which it does for some people, you know, who might get a little close to like loving the hotel, mm-hmm. right? Which some, so you have to be careful about that. But we do want to infuse ourselves with a sense of awe and respect of what's holy, and so that's why one would do that. But if you're going to bump into people, it's crowded, so just take a couple of steps back and then you can turn around. But yeah
I always sort of thought you were supposed to go just a little ways back and then
some people go all the way to the outside of the
fence
but.
So one other question vis-a-vis the holiness of the wall, when they opened up the tunnels mm-hmm. and you can go through, and supposing there's this one place that they think is the closest to the
right.
The Aron Kodesh. Uh-huh. So what about that area?
Right, so we're all Tameh, but it's not, it's the closest to, but it's not there. That is in the outside, that's mm-hmm. right. It's still in the city
outside.
Of Jerusalem. It's outside, so it's as close as you could get. And there may be some people who hold that you should go to the Mikvah before you go there. I'm not really sure. But I don't think that's the general way, because we, you know, religious tours go through there all the time, and... Mm. So it's not the same as the Temple Mount, where religious people basically don't go unless they've done preparation. So there are some people who do. They
and
go
now
to the
you really can't get up there.
And now, well, that's just politically.
Yeah.
But let's say they would
but
let.
But they used to be
yeah,
able to.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I've been there.
Right. So let's say they would let. If you're part of a religiously conscious group that's going, so you'd
if
go
you
to the mikvah
yourself.
First. Yeah, you'd go to the mikvah first to at least take away the tumas that you can.
Do have class next week.
And we do have class next week, Bezra. Yes. Great. Thanks so much.